overflowing with love. I am overflowing with happiness. I am filled with the power to make a change. You create a brand new life.
Welcome to the podcast of the Sunday Celebration from the Center for Spiritual Living in Huntsville, Alabama. We hope you feel the grace, the beauty, and the love of our community as you hear the message of the week.
For whom the bell tolls, y'all. And so I invite you to take... Thank you, Raul. I invite you to take your seat and to be still. You know, it's funny. The mind is the hardest thing to quiet. But once you turn it off, just like you turn off the television set, there's a deafening silence. My beloved mother used to always have the TV on. And she lived alone. And I'd say, Mom, do you always have the TV on? Why? And she said, it's company. I like to have company. And so when I would visit her, I would turn the TV off. And I could tell she was uncomfortable with that. And so we can notice our discomfort by the simple act of stopping and going within. My Zen calendar this morning was Muji. And Muji said, instead of always commenting with your mind about what is, he said, could you just open to what is without a comment? And I hear Thich Nhat Hanh in my heart saying, the birds are chirping outside the window. Could I smile to the birds that are chirping? Or if I'm Nancy, I'll say the tree outside my office has new green growth. And she's showing me how resilient this life force is after a long dormant winter. And without a commentary of the mind, the heart can simply smile. Yesterday afternoon, I received a beloved gift from Gigi and Raul. They put a little fish in the pond with Napoleon, who'd been Napoleon solo for a long time. He was alone. He was one of five, and then he was alone for at least a year, maybe two. And so they stopped by yesterday and put a little fish in there with Napoleon. I went out, and there was no fish to be found. And I looked and I looked, and I cleaned and I cleaned, and I took pots out from the bottom of the pond, thinking, he's hiding, he's hiding. And then my mind decided to label Napoleon a killer. You ate the little fish, Napoleon. And I was just besmirched. Until this morning, when I went out to feed him, and he was giving me his little mouth, opening and closing as he does, and swimming around his tail fins was the new little fish, going back and forth like Speedy Gonzales. And there's old Napoleon saying, well, you know, it's a little young for me, but I guess there's enough room in here for both of us. And in a holy instant, I changed my thought pattern. Instead of the conclusions that the mind had drawn, I said, forgive me, Napoleon, for judging you ill, when in truth it was my own mind running away with a stinking thought. And so when we can smile at our mind that tends to awfulize sometimes, then we have these skills to embrace the moment, not with a comment, not with a judgment, not with a reaction, but with a smile. And so this Sunday morning, we're going to be finishing a series called A New Design for Living. And I just finished a class. We have our last class this week called The Art of Living. And the beautiful thing about exploring an expanded idea is that that idea begins to unfold within the depths of your being, not as a concretized answer to a question, but as an ever-unfolding emergence of how life needs to be lived at this stage of our evolution. A life that embraces every moment, especially those challenging ones where we experience suffering, where we experience resistance. And we can see it all around us in the world. And so the invitation of the bell that Raoul so beautifully rang is to enter into that resonating field of suchness. Our last class was about nirvana. Nirvana is that place we get to touch within ourselves that's always there. It's that smile. It was Emerson that said, "It's only our finite self that wails and suffers, but there is simultaneously an infinite presence that lies stretched in smiling repose at the core of all life." That's the nirvana place. An infinite presence that lies stretched in smiling repose. So I invite you to invite that smile of the Buddha, the awakened one. Invite that smile of the Christ awareness. We just had a resurrection last week. And so now Jesus, the man, has now become the resurrected Christ within all creation. And we smile to that. Not as the last name of Jesus, but as the vibrational field of an awakened love that is as intimate as our own jugular vein, as it says in the Quran. A love that is so intimate that it knows no other. It sees itself everywhere revealed. And then when the bird sings outside the window, it's just like the ringing of the bell. It gives us permission to stop and to listen with our heart, not with a conclusion or a comment, but with a simple openness to listen with our heart and to hear what isn't being said. And then when a paradoxical thought like that arises, we smile to that thought. "Well, what do you mean to listen to what isn't being said? That's kind of confusing, David." And then you smile. Because you have arrived, you are home. And when we arrive, it means we stop running after or running away. We actually open to this spacious place within us and all around us that we're calling home. And I hear that song from The Wiz, "When I think of home, I think of a place where there's love overflowing." So could we go back home to that place where love is overflowing and know it as if for the first time, an overflowing love? So I invite you to open your eyes and enter into that field with me this Sunday morning. Not as a complicated place, but as a place of familiarity. You know, my beloved Angkor came back from Brazil and he and his partner have decided to go in different directions, but I reminded him that love, it never ever dies. And if you've ever known it, I recently saw this movie on Netflix. I wasn't going to talk about it, but it changed my life in a strange sort of way. It's called Cloudburst. And it's about two women in Maine who've been living together for a very long time. One is 80 years old. The other's in her mid-70s. The younger of the two is blind. And the older of the two is Olympia Dukakis. And the well-meaning family members, and we all have those, decide that they're going to put the 70-some-year-old in a nursing home saying that she's certifiable, and they're going to sell her house and evict the other woman and saying, "You got to get out of here because grandma's going in the nursing home." Well, Olympia Dukakis wasn't going to have it. After she fought the policemen who were taking her partner away, she went into the nursing home and stole her partner away from the nursing home and headed up to Canada with a bottle of tequila in her hand and saying, "We're going to get married in Canada and we're going to show them what true love is all about." And throughout this whole movie, I found myself cheering these two women as they fought for a love that the world did not approve of. And you know, I kind of resembled that experience. If you are in a world that doesn't acknowledge a different lifestyle. And so could we embrace the diversity of the world and see it with fresh eyes? That's this new design for living that we're exploring. Not the old. We all know what the old design for living was. You're raised in a certain environment. They have expectations of you. I remember I grew up in the Lutheran tradition where nobody got divorced. And so when my mother's marriage went awry, they said, "You'll call you a grass widow if you get divorced." So they stayed in this loveless marriage. And what an example they set for their kids. Because in those days, you just didn't do that, because that was the old design for living. And so here at the Center for Spiritual Living, we are so out of the box that everybody who has been a reject from their religion, you're welcome here. Because imagine no religion. I wonder if you can. Then you can embrace the deeper truths that are inherent within all. Ernest Holmes says we embrace all and we exclude none. So we just finished this lovely little class, The Art of Living, and Thich Nhat Hanh talks about, at the last chapter, moving into a consciousness of nirvana. And he says it's very important to know that nirvana isn't that place you go to when you die. He says nirvana is a place that's always there. And once all the nafs, the reactions, the suffering, the judgment, the confusion, and we all know what that's all about, once all of that burns away, he says, then what's left is this delicious peace that's always there. My Zen calendar this week was about seizing the day. And I had to laugh because you know that phrase, it was Horace that said, carpe diem, seize the day. They said, but seizing the day isn't grabbing a hamburger and scarfing it down. Seizing the day is much more gentle. It's when you see the bird on the bough and it's calling you to acknowledge it. It's when you see a little blueberry by the side of the road and you gently pick it. It's when a flower has fallen over in the garden and you cut it off and you put the iris on the table so it can be celebrated instead of lying in the dirt. Seizing the day is a gentle act. It's a mindful act. You know, it's an act that is always happening. So could we learn to design our life moment to moment, where every corner you turn is an opportunity to find nirvana? There's a wonderful Zen koan that says, the house burned down, but now I can see the moon. And I think of Ukraine when I hear that. I mean, Mariupol has been burned down, but I can see that the spirit of the Ukrainian people, the spirit of the Ukrainian people. Trey says, are you going to wear that? I said, I'm going to wear it until the Ukrainians have found peace in their homeland. So could we hold the high watch for someone like that who is so courageous and not be looking at the devastation? Even though the devastation is horrifying, we get to know that the house burned down, but maybe consciousness of love and of democracy is awakening within the hearts on this planet. Something, as Jody would say, there's got to be a puppy in there somewhere. So let me just give you a taste of him at the very end on nirvana, because it's so delicious. And feel the transmission of the wisdom of this. I used to call him a living saint, and he still is living in my book. He said the Buddha used the word nirvana to describe the pleasant experience of the cooling of the flames of our afflictions. Now, in order to have nirvana, you got to have some afflictions, beloved Angkor. So could we touch those afflictions with gentleness, carpe diem, and find that there's nirvana right there? The love didn't go anywhere. The love is still there. You know, my beloved Bert and Speck were so much in love with one another. And as all great love affairs, one has to go first, and she went first. And but she was still with him. The love never died with the two of them. And you heard me share last week how there was one stage where he was possessed by her chasing the ball. He never did that. There was another time she was terrified of thunder and lightning. She would shiver like a leaf. He never had any fear. All of a sudden, the thunderstorms are back in Huntsville, and Bert's standing by the side of my chair, shivering like a leaf. And I said, you just didn't get the ball thing from baby. You got the fear of the thunderstorm. So I put him in her thunder shirt, and he shivered, and I smiled because I knew that something in her was still there. Now, that was a moment of nirvana for me, because it was a confirmation that spirit never dies. It's always here. He goes, the flames of your affliction, when you stop identifying them as bad, you can realize that that's sacred pain. That's holy pain. He says, when we transform our suffering and remove the idea that it's wrong, very naturally, well, then we can touch that refreshing peace. And this is nirvana. Beloved Sylvia had a procedure in her heart, a heart valve replacement. And, you know, you could think, oh, ain't that awful? But I shared with, before she went under the procedure, I said, I've never been healthier than when I had the stent put in. And beloved Gigi's going tomorrow because her get up and go has gone up and went. And now she's going to have a similar procedure. And you know, it was so benign. I couldn't believe it. I had all these images of what heart surgery looks like, that they cut me open and do this. He went in through a little thing on my wrist. And I said, I wanted to show the scar to somebody, and there's nary a spot. Where did you go in me? And he said, well, they're right there, you know. And I feel like a brand new person. So could that be a moment of nirvana when I let go of the thought that, oh my God, my body's betraying me? No. And then if you're like Marie Perez, you start tapping it, and the body just wants to be acknowledged. You know, when Napoleon's down there in the bottom of the pond, and I think he's, you know, depressed, he doesn't want to get up, he's down by the pump, he's kind of, you've all seen Castaway when Tom Hanks fell in love with Wilson, the ball, and that was his companion. Well, I think Napoleon was imprinting on the pump. And so it's nice that you brought the little fish. So now that he has a relationship with something other than the pump. But he was down there and I thought he was depressed. You know how we anthropomorphize our fish. So I took a stick and I tapped him on the back, you know, fins. You know, come on up. You don't have to be depressed back there. I'm still here. And he goes up, mwah, mwah. And then we have a relationship and I'm talking to the fish. Moments of nirvana. You're going crazy, David. I know you're going crazy. Back to nirvana. He says, this is the intimate connection between the suffering and nirvana. If we did not suffer, we could not recognize the peace of nirvana. So without this suffering, there could be no awakening from the suffering. Just as without the hot coals, we cannot have a cool ash. So suffering and awakening go together. You have to have the darkness in order to find the light. In the beginning, darkness was on the face of the earth, the very first words of the Bible, and God said, let there be light. So what if when we're going through those dark times, we get to turn in and touch that little spot of illumination, that part that doesn't die, that never dies, and your dogs show you the way. Boy, they do in my life. As we learn to handle this suffering, well, then we are learning to generate a moment of nirvana. I love it. Nancy said she's been cultivating little moments of nirvana ever since she read the chapter. Go for a walk and notice what happens in your world. I've been growing all these odd little seedlings, and as someone pointed out, you put them in the garden and then the squirrels and the chipmunks destroy them. And so you have to make peace with the chipmunks and the squirrels that are throwing your seedlings out. But then when you find that little abandoned seedling by the side of the pot and you re-put it in the pot and you bury it and you water it and it comes back, well, I've got so many Lazaruses in my garden. I call them all Lazarus because they seemingly come back from the dead. A moment of nirvana, a moment of suffering, a moment of peace. Find those little moments in your life if you can. And he says, each one of us can touch a small moment of nirvana throughout our day. The removal of afflictions is the presence of nirvana. And as you recognize, embrace, and transform your anger, your fear, and your despair, well, then you have arrived. You are home in the field of nirvana, which is waiting for you and is waiting for me.
Well, is it that simple?
I think so. It's just waiting for us.
Well, I'd rather suffer, because at least when I suffer, I can feel my pain, and then I can share with the world. And the world loves to go down the path of suffering.
I said, I know they do. But what if I told you could be free? Like that. So the class ends this week. The students do their projects. We're going to take a break. And then through popular demand, we're going live here at the center. I'm going to teach the next class here. I'm going to do a day class, and then I'm going to do a night satsang. So we'll have two options for people. And the text that I'm choosing is something that is so refreshingly different. It's not Buddhist at all. It's a non-dual teacher named John Burney, and it's called Ordinary Freedom. And basically, it's the fact that the freedom is always there, but we don't go to the freedom. We go to the bondage. We go to the suffering. And so what if we could make a commitment to be ambassadors of freedom? And that, you know, in the Buddhist tradition, they call it moksha. The whole purpose of all this is to set ourselves free of the tyranny of the local self, the me person. That's that whole concept of emptiness in Buddhism. When you know you're empty of this person and what you are is everything and nothing, well, then you're free. But when you're so obsessed with my story and my problems, well, then you want to find solutions to those problems. And you know, life is not a problem to be solved. It's this glorious adventure that's always unfolding. It's unfolding one breath at a time. And that's why it's so important to simply learn to breathe, to breathe into this present moment. So in this month of, we're in April, the theme is the new design for living. In the first week, I explored the idea of the practice of relationships, that we're always in relationship with the present moment, with each other, with our body, with our mind, with our emotions. And when you learn to be in relationship with yourself, then you can be in relationship with other. And we get to see how skillful we are at doing that. You know, it's not about changing the other person. It's about accepting them where they are and embracing the diversity. Jody said there's a young lady, Shannon, that might be watching us from Decatur today. And if you are, I can't wait to meet you, because I know you'll fit into this crazy tribe of ours here in Huntsville. Because we embrace everyone, especially those who dare to be unique and different and not conform. It was Emerson that said, conformity and consistency are the hobgoblin of little minds and the divine of statesmen. We're not here to conform to a political agenda, to some kind of... Trey was telling me in the New Yorker magazine, there's an article, some of the best writing is in the New Yorker magazine, about how consciousness in America, after World War I, they had a flu that broke out and killed so many people. And that was during the time when they had the Scopes trials in Tennessee about teaching evolution in school. And it was just like today when the anti-gay thing's going on in Florida. They said, we want parents to tell their children about evolution. Adam and Eve were the first two people and we all spawned from Adam and Eve. We don't want this evolution taught in our schools. So way back then, we said, we're not doing science in the schools. We're going back to the good old fundamentalist religion. And the New Yorker says, it's repeating the same path. Don't tell my children about diversity. God forbid, you know, the word gay is mentioned. And you know, I just couldn't help but smile because I evolved out of that consciousness that was so closeted, who now can be openly what I am. And that's the beauty, to burn away all the dross. So we talked about the necessity of relationships. We're always having it. Relationships with the past, relationships with your church, relationships with your parents, relationships with your body, with your mind, with your emotions. And it was Ram Dass that said, relationship is the toughest yoga of them all. Now, having said that, could we then smile at that idea? I don't consider it tough. It's tough if you resist it, but it's easy if you embrace it. Then you have relationships with the sunrise. You have relationships, you know, we're going to have a board meeting after this session today. And I love meeting with our board members because Trey gets food for us. He likes to prepare food. He's such a wonderful husband. He's the treasurer. He always makes sure there's a treasurer's report. He did the sign-up sheets today. See, he wants me to look good and respectable to the world. So he gives me that polished look. Now that's working together as a team. And that's about relationships. He also, after 50 years together, he likes to do his things by himself. So this week he's leaving on Monday or Tuesday, depending on the weather, flying first class to New York City, where he's going to be spreading his sister's ashes to find the appropriate places. His sister Susan died of cancer of the tongue. She was upstate New York, lived alone with her dog Henry. We found a home for Henry after Susan passed. It was just the two of them. But the love of her life was Biff. And he was a young man in 1965 that signed up for the Vietnam War. They got married. He went to Vietnam. Within 6 months, he was blown up. So they're going to try to find Biff's grave and put Susan's ashes with Biff. And I said, well, she had a favorite pub in Manhattan. You can sprinkle a few around the tree at the pub where she'd go and be with her friends. And there's something sweet about having an appointment with destiny where you get to... find little moments of nirvana, because Susan is still here. You know, spirit never dies. So there's this adventure that he gets to have. And I love that. So that was the first week, the practice of relationships. The second week, I explored the idea of shedding the masks. We've all been given the masks that we have to wear. You know, the appropriate person, the mother, the daughter, the professional woman, the this's or the that's, until you can't wear the mask anymore. And you just have to be who you are. You don't have to hide. And the trouble with a mask is it's something we hide behind. And when you can no longer wear those things that you hide behind, well, then you're free to be what you are. So shedding the masks. What masks are you willing to shed? Last week, I explored the idea of the reach of kindness. What if it's all about kindness? It was His Holiness the Dalai Lama that said, my religion is kindness. So you go through life doing the kind thing. Beloved Adam texted me this week because his sister found, I think it was a white-breasted nuthatch, the mother, and she had the fledgling babies, and the mother was dead, and there were these fledglings going around. And so she rescued it, and Adam came and picked up the little fledgling, and he sent me a photograph, and there she was lying on his chest. And he said, oh, I have my own little octopus teacher. She was laying on her heart to his heart, and he was having this bonded experience with this little bird. And she was very dear. So he created a home for her, and he put her in that home. And when he went down the next morning, she died from crib death. She was no longer there. And he was grieving the loss of her. And I said, but I said, you had an experience of love that was irreplaceable. And I said, and the little bird knew that she was loved, that she was held. So could we see the grace in that and touch that with compassion and find the nirvana, even in a painful loss, there was grace. You know, I saw something on Facebook that said, when you lose an animal, the veterinarians would say, what's the saddest thing? And they say, when someone will take their animal to the vet and they're not there during the moment of death, they say that those animals will be looking for their human. Where is my human? And so if you have an animal that needs to be euthanized, make sure you're holding it in your arms, that you're letting it know that it's loved. I remember when Effie made her transition, I carried her to the vets and she had her head under my armpit the whole way I was driving her to the vets. We went into that room. She still had her head under my armpit where she felt secure. I'm holding her in my arms. She was really fragile and old at this stage. And she went knowing that she was loved with every breath that she took right to the very end. So what if in those acts of kindness, we get to be mindful in every single corner that we experience this life, to be kind to the seedling in the pot. I came to church early this Sunday because I wanted to make sure that the little seedlings that I had planted had been watered in. And there's something beautiful about tending a garden. You know, it was Voltaire that wrote that wonderful book, Candide. And Candide is the story of a young man who's in search of himself. So he travels the whole world over. So many of us do, trying to find himself. And he has all these adventures. They made a musical about Candide. He finally ends up in that little village of France where he started the journey. It's like you, Angkor, coming back after all these years. And at the very end of the book, the hero of the story said, I guess all we're here to do is to tend our own garden. He came back to the place that he began, and he realized it's just about being with what is. In a kind sort of way, you can search the whole world over for happiness, as Emerson said, but if you're not carrying it within you, you're not going to find it. So the same is true for peace. The same is true for love. You're not going to find it somewhere out there when conditions are right if you don't find it right now. So then you find paradoxically there's a purpose in this suffering. And when you can master your own suffering, well, then you can be there for Terry Boy when he's suffering. And Thich Nhat Hanh so beautifully says, if you haven't mastered it, you can't help anybody. So don't go to somebody who is still suffering and expect them to give you peace. Jody was so helpful when baby Speck was suffering because she recognized in her wisdom that Trey and I were suffering more than she was suffering. She had PTSD. She ran out in a thunderstorm. She was nervous, shaking. She was a mess and we were a mess. And Jody said, you need to be that calm space for her. And you know, it's just like, of course, this bell goes off, of course. That's the way we get to approach life. Jody just had a new little grandbaby, and I see all these photographs of this grandmother holding this little baby. And you know she's transmitting this grandmotherly love to this little angel, and there's a soul connection there. There's a soul contract, and the soul recognizes that. Now, is she trying to mold this little baby Jane into some idea that she should be a certain way? I don't think so. I think she's saying, I know you're in there, and you're a beautiful expression of the one life, and I'm here to nurture you. Now, that's the reach of kindness. You know, Anastasia's little boy, Seth, came to one of our satsangs one night. This little boy, now he's a big boy, and he had a lizard of sorts. It was this crazy looking thing. I was a little afraid of it. But after I overcame that initial fear, all of a sudden that little lizard creature was lying on different people's hearts and was experiencing this darshan heart to heart. And you know, you realize that all you were experiencing was a thought that it's a scary looking thing. Yeah, it's kind of scary looking, but really at its core, it was just a child that wanted to be loved. And so this beautiful mother of a son gave her son the opportunity to be the instrument of kindness. And you see how that changes. You know, in my twin sister's scenario, her oldest son is finally turning out to be the hero of the story because they're trying to commit my twin sister to a mental institution. She had a urinary tract infection. They said she's crazy. So the power of attorney wanted to put her in a mental institution. And I called my nephew and I said, you know, your mom isn't crazy. She's just odd as a $3 bill. And I said, that makes her really dear. I mean, she's kind of, my twin sister's kind of crazy. And he said, yeah, I know. And I said, but that's endearing. So now all of a sudden he's becoming the good son. He picked up his mom. He's getting a divorce. It's his second divorce. He got custody of all the children. And so I said to my nephew, Arthur, I said, you know, you're setting such a good example to your children by you being the compassionate one with your mother, my sister. And I said, you know, actions speak louder than words. So now he's being the good son, taking care of his mom, instead of buying into the idea that somehow she's mentally non compos mentis, that she's just a 70-some-year-old lady who's odd. So now the plan is, and I'm supposed to be in the middle of the plan, is to rescue her, to scoop her from Idaho, to take her to Oregon, where a whole new life awaits her. So I said, you know, I'll buy you a dog. I'll get you a car. What do you want? You want a rocking chair? How about a room to do? She hooks rugs. I'll get you a craft room and you can hook your rugs and you can teach them how to hook rugs out there in Oregon. Oh, yeah, that sounds great. That's the reach of kindness. So this Sunday, to end this new design for living, the question is, could we burn off what's unnecessary? To burn off what's unnecessary. You know, you've heard me talk about Rumi, the great mystic. And he says, my life can be boiled down to three phrases. I burned and I burned and I burned till nothing left was ash. And the ash, you could say, is the nirvana. So what burns away? Everything that's unnecessary. The belief systems, the opinions, the judgments, the doctrination that you had from the church. You know, I remember there was a young lady that came here and she was from Church of Christ in Arab. And she was concerned because she came to the center and she's a lesbian. And she says, my greatest concern that my parents have is number one, that I would go to a spiritual center like this and leave the Church of Christ. And the second greatest fear is that I'd be a lesbian. And she said, and I'm both. Oh, but you know what was beautiful? She learned that she had to leave Arab and she went up to upstate New York and her life is flowering because she had to burn away what was unnecessary was the doctrine in which she lived in order to set herself free to be who she is. And so I celebrate that diversity. So here's what Mark Nepo talks about burning away. This is not an easy thing. It hurts to burn away the stuff. This is how he puts it at the end of the book. Burning away what's unnecessary. He says, we gather things, we get covered, filmed over by our ideas and our experiences and our memories, and they mute us and they scar us. And so there's a need to return to who we were before we were born. Huh. But to be wiser. And he says, as a meteor that would enter our atmosphere, it would burn off all of its excess. And our life is like a moving meteor. And it moves through time and it burns off what is unnecessary. You don't think that way anymore. You've stepped out of that mindset. You've stepped out of that tribe of yesterday. You're no longer a member of the Church of Christ. You've come here to the Center of Spiritual Living, and you're free to not think anything, to have no beliefs. I wonder if you can. He said, this is a human form of erosion. We're wearing away what's not essential. So could you ask yourself, what's not essential anymore in my life? Do we have to have judgments and opinions? Not necessarily. Do we have to have a belief system? Well, I don't think you do. All belief arises from the ego. Well, who would I be without a belief system? I say, you'd be free. Well, I don't know if I could handle freedom. Freedom, it might be too daunting. I'd rather have the cage of my conditioned mindset. Well, or not. So could you let that which needs to fall away, and then what's left? I love that song. Imagine no religion. I wonder if you can. No one to die for. Da, 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 da. And that's all getting away. No one is exempt from this demanding process. And of course, this burning off is going to be painful. How could it not be? It's a mysterious initiation, and it's hard for many to endure. But only what will last ultimately remains. So when the form dies, the love doesn't die. The love is always there. If you've ever had a relationship, if your parents are no longer here on the planet, the love is still there. You know, I have a constant connection to the ancestors. I believe that they live in me. My teachers live in me. So, like a stone that's netted in the branches that's held over a fire, we are in a time burned free of our entanglements. Who would have imagined such a fate for us? Who could have imagined the ways that life covers us and then ultimately sets us free? And yet, on the other side, we are bare and smooth and sturdy if we can help each other through this. So we're going to burn and burn and burn, and then all that's left is the real. Could we invite that real? And then to let this new design come from that part of ourself that is no longer programmed or conditioned. Then there's a sense of spontaneity. There's a sense of aliveness. There's a sense of being who you are. In that wonderful movie Cloudburst, there's a young man who rescues these two ladies who are fleeing America, and he's a lost soul. And he becomes, in a way, the hero because the blind lesbian tells him that he can be whatever he wants to be. And he wanted to be a dancer. And so even when the old lady dies at the end, instead of being appropriate at her graveside, he starts to dance around her grave as a celebration of his spirit. So Angkor, if I die, I want you dancing around my grave, because it was an authentic expression of his love for her. Not a controlled way of doing it, but a spontaneous way of saying, I'm going to live, you're going to live, your freedom, your eyes, I'll be your eyes now. She was blind, and she'd go out and she'd stand on the cliffs with her partner. And she'd say, what do the clouds look like? That's why it's called Cloudburst. And Olympia Dukakis would say, well, I'm looking up at the sky and I'm seeing a big donkey with two nuns sitting on its fanny eating a piece of pizza. And then she would laugh. And that's how they would share the moment. Because she didn't have eyes, but she had eyes. And together they were experiencing this beautiful dance called life together. So this new design for living is what you're going to make it. And I love the fact that we get to really consciously, I quoted Muhammad Ali last week, who said, if you're at age 50 and you say, I'm just the way I was at 20, you've wasted 30 years of your life. So what if we're here to evolve and to grow and to shed, you know, to shed? In the Sufi tradition, they talk about fana, which is the first step, which is in a way the death of the local self. And after this annihilation, this burning comes, then there's a thing called baka, which means it's abiding in that awakened place. So once all that's unnecessary burns away, all that me stuff, the story, the victimhood, there's a wonderful book called The Grace of Aging. And at the very end of this book, she says, as we get older, we should be shedding all our opinions and beliefs and reactions so that when we come to the end of our life, we're open. We're open to what life brings to us. So if there's a procedure that you have to have in the morning to open your heart, you smile to that procedure. And you're not a victim of it, but you are openly, consciously meeting life as this glorious, glorious way to design it. And you know what? You're not in control of the design. The beloved is. So then when the beloved brings you a little bird by the side of the road, you say, this too is the beloved. This too is good. This too is for me. And I claim the blessing. It's all being blessed by what life brings us. And then the suffering becomes, it's out of the mud the lotus grows. It just becomes the mud that's necessary for the flowering of life. And then if you've lived as long as I have and you've had enough mud in your life, you realize that it was all sacred. I was going to close today with a prayer by Llewellyn Van Lee in his book, Spiritual Ecology. And in that he says, as we evolve, as we shed the idea of me and my opinions, and you know, we just had Earth Day this week, and how are we seeing the planet? Are we seeing it as a part of ourselves? In spiritual ecology, they say, and Angkor knows this too, it's all a living, sentient being. And I watch so many things on nature about the otters and the kelp fields and how everything works with everything else to support this life force. They had a thing on the wisdom of the whales, the orca whales. And you know, the orca whales are led by the female matriarch. And they say they can live to be hundreds of years old. And you have these old orca females guiding all the little orca ones and showing them how to fish and how to eat and how to take care of their orca siblings. And I'm thinking, oh my God, they're more civilized than humans. And the more you watch nature, you realize this is life. And we're a part of that. So at the end of Spiritual Ecology, Llewellyn Van Lee talks about embracing nature as our own self. So everything is, how you treat everything is that new design for living. Again, we're back to Candide. How are you growing your garden? How are you tending your garden? What seeds are you watering? Are you watering seeds of nirvana? Are you watering seeds of acceptance? Are you watering seeds of radiant health? When you start watering those seeds of radiant health and unlimited energy, well, then they start restoring themselves. But if you water the seeds of anger, and you water the seeds of resentment, and you water the seeds of bitterness, well, what do you think you're going to grow in the garden of your consciousness? And that's how simple it is. And one thing you also learn in this new design for living, you can't determine the outcome. That's the one flaw that religious science has about mental equivalence. They say, really get clear what you want to see. It's never going to look the way you think it is. It's going to look the way it is. And so you can have this idea of who Mr. or Miss Wright should look like or what your job should look like. But it's never going to be what you think it is. It's going to be what it is. A gardener knows that. And then you enjoy it. Oh, my God, it's so much more beautiful than what I could have programmed into the universe. Look at how Seth has turned out. I had no clue that he'd be that tall with such a deep voice, that little boy that walked in here with a dragon on his shoulder. My God. And so what if we can just say, okay, this is the life I've been giving. You design it the way you want it. So I'm going to do a little closing meditation. If Raul wants to go to the bell. And isn't he a wonderful bell ringer?
Yes.
He's my hero in so many ways. He's had some physical challenges. And you know, he always approaches those physical challenges as an opportunity to live mindfully. He doesn't say, oh, ain't it awful that I have a blood clot in my leg? He goes, isn't it wonderful that I can take blood thinner and I can meet this thing in a conscious way? And so then everything becomes an opportunity. That's a new design for living. Not to be a victim of the moment, but to be a co-creator with it. So if you'd like to ring the bell, my beloved brother. Oh, there it is. Is that not sacred? So I touch the sound of the bell within my heart. And it brings a smile to my face. And all it took was that simple ring and that stopping and going within and witnessing what is always there. Once everything else burns away, what's left? You might say there's this observer self that's there, that's observing maybe a cough that's arising from within. And so instead of resisting the cough, because you know if you resist a cough, you cough more, then you smile to the cough and you take a deep breath. And then you drink a sip of water. Let me give Reva the sip of water. And what if life is one moment-to-moment experience of what's arising and how we meet what's arising, and we smile to that. I was coming to the center this morning, and I was at the stoplight at Bailey Cove and Whitesburg, and a car turned left off of Airport, and it crossed right in front of me and nearly hit me because it wasn't in the other lane, it was in my lane. And I was vigilant enough, because I was driving in silence, I wasn't distracted, that I could put on my brake. And I didn't get angry at the person that nearly hit me. I was just grateful that I had the foresight to put on my brakes and not have a collision. And so what if life is one beautiful moment-to-moment adventure? And when we're conscious, when we're awake, we touch those moments of maybe unskillfulness, those moments of Thich Nhat Hanh would call them suffering, samsara, the struggles of life. And we touch them with an act of kindness. And we say to ourselves, I'm here for you to help you navigate. My beloved Marie Perez is dealing with some physical challenges, and she's learned to listen to the guidance from within herself. And she smiles because by listening to the inner teacher, she's finding solace and balance, And she's finding a creative way to embrace the moment. So that's her new design for living. So this Sunday, I invite you to live in the question, how then shall we live? Knowing that we are not bound by yesterday's conclusions, yesterday's mindset. We're not bound by the world's opinions, judgments, conclusions, indoctrination. How then shall we live, knowing that this divine presence is as intimate as our own breath? Wow. How would our life look like if we knew that this, instead of being an ego with opinions and demands and concerns, that we are this living presence that we see all around us? The tree outside Nancy's window is giving darshan to Nancy, and it's showing her how to be empty and to be fully present, and to allow this life force, this Holy Spirit, to move through her. And as Nancy looks at the tree, she smiles because she knows that they're not separate. And so could we look through the eyes of oneness in this new design? Not through the eyes of me, but through the eyes of Pachimama, the Divine Mother, who's within us, and Pachipapa, the Celestial Father. And so we have within us this cosmic, divine, masculine, galactic, spacious awareness, the infinite mind of the universe. And yet we have the heart of the mother that nurtures all her children, that cares for even the least of these. So ponder the question, and the Talmud says, why ruin a perfectly good question with an answer? Ponder the question, how would Pachimama and Pachipapa live this individualized life that we are experiencing, knowing that we're part of something so much greater? And then live in that with a smile, with a curiosity, with a willingness to open to the mystery that doesn't have answers, but that has fascination, that has awe and wonder. And just slide into that awe and that wonder and smile. It's Emerson that says, be and not seem. He says, let us acquiesce, surrender. Let us get our bloated nothingness out of the way. And when we do, we connect with the divine circuits. So we come here on Sundays to connect with the divine circuits. The implication is that they're always there, but it does require that we plug in. So I invite you to sit with intention, to open your heart chakra, to open your crown chakra, to invite the universe to reveal her mysteries to you, one smile at a time, and say, I am ready. I am open. I trust and I allow. Place your hand over your heart chakra if you feel inclined to, and join with me in the heart salutation, saying to this intelligence within and all around, I honor you.
I respect you.
I love you. You are the radiant presence of the One, ever unfolding within and all around, smiling to the inevitable moment, saying yes a thousand times yes, with umpteen gratitudes and cheerful expectancy, as we take the next step with kindness and mindfulness and curiosity. So open your eyes, look around you at your own self. This is it. You have arrived. You are home. So good to see everybody. Thanks for sending your tithes in out there. There's a basket in the back of the room. Mwah.
To make a change, to create a brand new life. I
Thank you for listening to our podcast. For more information, please visit www.cslhuntsville.org.